If someone records a podcast and releases it, but no one listens to it, was it ever released? It's like the tree in the forest one, isn't it?
Yeah. Does it make a noise if no one's there to hear it?
Yeah, well, of course it does.
Or does it?
All the squirrels will be like, yeah.
Yeah, but then the squirrels are someone to hear it. If there was no squirrels, nothing at all, no living thing there to hear, that can hear.
Yes.
Would it make a noise? No, it wouldn't.
Yes, it would. No, it definitely does make a noise, even if no one's around to hear it. I know for a fact because I've recorded it on my recording studio and I heard it, so.
Oh, is that why they've got those secret cameras in the woods?
No, that's to catch things like deer and badgers mating and things like that, isn't it?
That's a different podcast.
Well, this is my favourite podcast, actually, the badger mating podcast.
I wonder where that would be popular in the world. That's interesting.
Where there are many badgers.
Do badgers have iPads? This is a market that could be looked into, Apple.
Why would badgers have iPads?
Well, why not? They can send messages to each other.
So I just heard a tree fall over. No one was around. What do you mean it made noise? Of course it didn't.
Sorry, anyway. We're not talking about surrealism. We're talking about realism.
That'll be my dyslexia coming out then and misspelling it.
Yeah, that'll be it.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a bit of frog in my throat now. We've just literally started recording, which is, I don't know if that makes me sound sexy or it makes me sound like I'm about to die.
Well, a little bit like badger mating podcasts and that sort of thing. It appeals to somebody. There's a picture.
Right, let's record it. Hello and welcome back.
Thanks for joining us for another episode.
I am Malcolm Childs.
And I am James Skiffins, and we are Just Making Conversation.
This is Season 2, where we discuss the ins and outs of the model-making hobby that brings us joy and pain in equal measure.
From the greasy sprues and the gloss coats and everything in between, we are going to be Just Making Conversation.
Remember, there are other podcasts you can listen to.
Plastic Model Mojo.
The Scale Model Podcast.
Plastic Posse Podcast.
On the Bench.
Model Geeks.
The Sprue Cutters Union.
Small Subjects.
And Built Sideways.
Head to modelpodcasts.com for all of the links. If you've enjoyed our podcast, consider leaving a review, as it promotes this podcast to more people to enjoy.
Showing your support to us is easy as making a cup of coffee. In fact, why not go over to buymeacoffee.com/JMC podcast and do just that. Your support will help go towards making the podcast and its content just a little bit better.
In this episode, we will be just making conversation about the art of realism. Is it a requirement to make your models look real, or should you bother at all? What makes the difference so that the model you're making doesn't look like a toy?
Making your model as close to the subject matter at hand is important, as it is an interpretation of the real thing. So you can't always achieve all the micro detail, but maybe an impression is good enough.
How do we define real? Everyone sees things in different ways and attributes different feelings and have different memories. Photographs can still be manipulated even though they are considered to be a strong way of recording an image. Perhaps a representation of the thing you are making is enough, as at the end of the day, it will never be absolutely accurate.
We are having a little change around on our social media outlets. We will no longer be taking messages through Twitter.
Nope.
The account's still live, so it's still there. But we won't be reading any comments from there. So if you want to make any comments, so you can send us an email, of course.
To podcast.jmc@gmail.com.
Or, of course, you can catch us on the Facebook page.
Just search for Just Making Conversation.
The other way is through the buymeacoffee.com JMC podcast.
Yep.
Been promising for a little while is that I would put a little bit more content up on there. You don't have to make a donation or buy a coffee to follow us. It is free. But what I'm going to try and do is I'm going to try and increase the traffic of posts on that medium, and there will be some exclusive stuff on that medium. So if you haven't done already, head over to buymeacoffee.com/JMC podcast and become a follower.
Now, the reason we're doing that, it's just like having 30 different letterboxes in your house, and the postman just decides to randomly use a different one every time. So you don't know where the post is. You don't know where the comments are coming from. And if you haven't checked every bit of social media, then you might miss something. And quite often we do.
Yeah.
Because we've also get comments, and when we get posts, and then we get emails, and then people say something to us as well, and then they send us a carrier pigeon and a raven, and it all gets mixed up. So
yeah,
we try and streamline it, aren't we?
Trying to, but we've discussed it, and we are thinking as to whether we use the Instagram account as much as we do. I think we will, because I don't mind using that, but that's on notice. So that may, we'll see. Depends how we get on with the other media.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's get some comments in. So our first one up is from Frank Ramsey.
Frankie.
And this is in relation to the wargaming episode. Mm. He says, yes, they do count, at least more complex kits. And often they are a great palate cleanser between more serious builds. So they do count, but they're not quite as serious as a serious build.
Mm.
Thank you, Frank.
Frankie, mate. Frank the Tank, some call him. The other comment we have here is from Nat. I'm replying to your post about the wargaming models actually a model. Then absolutely, I would say yes. To me, modelling is about sticking pieces together and potentially painting to create an end piece. Yes, the scales are smaller than classic modelling and they might not be based on factual things, but the end result is the same. Something to show off with pride. Thank you, Nat.
Thanks, Nat. That's wonderful. Talking about exclusive pictures, etc., one of the things that's been going on the community within the buymeacoffee.com is I've put some pictures up about the Moosaroo build, and Gordon has commented on that saying, looks great, looking forward to the final entry pictures. We'll talk about the Moosaroo in a bit more depth later.
Do you remember the last podcast, how we spent about 15 minutes laughing at the words final entry pictures?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, that was a lot of editing I had to do. Ended up cutting the whole thing out because no one would get what a final entry picture is and why it was funny.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they would if we, showed them a final entry picture. But then we'd get removed. So, Mr. Wolf, Andrew Wolf, with two Fs. Wolfie, we used to call him at school.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Good luck with Moosaroo, he says, and please share all the gory details on the build and paint after you've won. Wow, signing that check already, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
So long again. Andrew from Minneapolis, USA. Oh, and he says, P.S., my 12-year-old nephew and I were both genuinely delighted a few episodes ago to hear Malcolm pronounce Minneapolis correctly as Mini-Apple Penis. Without coaching, he says. I must have done that right by accident.
Oh, yeah. Next up was an email from Paul. And he says, of course, I must start with a big thank you for the podcast. It is a joy to listen to both. Sorry.
Does the word toss throw you off?
Yeah. I thought, oh, he's edited this in a rot.
I haven't. He literally wrote that.
So Paul's emailed us. He says, of course, I must start with a big thank you for the podcast. It is a joy to listen to you both toss around some interesting ideas while keeping it lighthearted and supportive. Oh, cool. I am yet again recent returnee to the hobby, and the podcasts have been one of the most important ways I've managed to feel included once again and had my education brought up to date over the past 2 years.
Cool.
Actually, my main reason for writing is that I was keen to find out about the model depicted in the artwork you used for episode 21, Going Small. Are you able to tell me who the model is? I've tried Googling for Dak in a walnut, and all I got was recipes. It stuck in my mind, and I think the key inspiration for a bit of model magic I attempted recently with a spare 1/144th Kubelwagen. There is a link to an Instagram post that you put up. which we will share on the Facebook group and the buymeacoffee.com community. And also I've put with that the link of where that's come from. But anyway, so PS, I'm interested in your reaction, especially after listening to a latest episode, which from which I gather Malcolm is not a fan, he says, of putting electronics in models. And that's Paul from Singapore. Just so you know, the original image we used for episode 21 was from a modeler called Mark Zacks. Now, the YouTube link is on our social media in relation to this email, along with the Instagram post from Paul, so you can compare the two. I'm not going to tell you any more than that. It's well worth the watch. But yeah, that information's there. And thanks, Paul. Thanks for sending the email. And it has actually potentially given us a little bit of inspiration, but we'll tell you about that later. Hold that thought.
Lastly, Gary Morris. Oh, yes. I'm Malcolm and James. He says, what's James in Maltese again? Just an update on their giggling and vibrating in the bed. Oh, okay. Yes, Gary was the chap who had a very cross wife because woken up while listening to us in bed. He says, just an update on the giggling and vibrating in bed situation. The JMC is now banned from my bedroom, so I have to giggle and vibrate in the man cave. Keep up the fantastic work. From Gary, well, we're very sorry.
Yes, we're sorry, Mrs. Gary. Yes.
Just remember to lock the door from inside, if that's what you're going to be doing.
What are you doing in there?
Listening to JMC, love.
Oh, all right then.
Not really. Looking at the porn.
Oh, dear. Well, that's all the comments. Thanks so much. I really do appreciate it. We do answer all of them. Sometimes. No, we do. We answer all of them. Sometimes a little bit late because we miss them.
I think, though, if you really, really need to contact us and we have missed you, then email us because we will see that. Both of us will see that properly and we'll have a proper record of it. And it won't be hidden in the back of a social media post somewhere. Right. What are we talking about? We're talking about me going for a wee.
Okay.
This is a wee. Back in a sec. Realism, James, is what we're talking about next. Do you have some very strong and controversial opinions about realism that we can discuss? And don't just start the conversation with
realism. It's really shit, isn't it?
Realism to me is, it's in the eye of the beholder, isn't it, at the end of the day? Mm-hmm. I find it incredibly difficult to suggest that something I've made in a smaller scale is realistic. Once you've answered the doorbell.
Pause. Sorry, postman.
That's right. For me, realism is one of those subjects in which goes along the same lines of how are we artists, I guess, your interpretation of what you do. I think it's almost impossible to make something of scale look realistic 100%. So I'm very much along the train of thought of what we do is an interpretation or an impression of whatever it is we're doing, be it a figure or a tank or whatever. And I'm also a great believer in the fact that model makers that make representations of a photo are great, don't get me wrong. I take my hat off to them, and that I don't 100% care for, because my opinion is that if I was standing next to the person taking that picture, my view potentially could be very different to what that person is taking that picture of, although it's the same thing we're looking at. That's my thought on the modelling process, really, is that we try to achieve something that looks realistic, i.e. it looks like it's like a tank's been through a desert. It, you know, it's got dust and whatever on, and sand, and you know, it looks like it's been through the desert. That's my understanding of realism in scale model making.
I think the clue is in the name of the hobby, this is scale model making. So the every part and piece of your model is in the same place as it is on the real one. It's in proportion, it's the right size. The wheels are the right size, it's the right shape, because it's a scale version of it. Now, of course, light and everything else reacts differently in different sizes and different distances. You heard about scale color? You heard about that before?
Yeah.
So the further away you're looking at it, something, the more lighter it'll be or washed out.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if you look at the horizon, 30 miles away on the horizon, that is all washed out because the air is dense enough to cause the light to be, you know, diffused. I guess the same thing would happen with or scale models. Not that I bother with that, because the difference would be tiny. But as with all things, these tiny little scale models, you want to try and make them look bigger, even though they're tiny. You want to make them look as real as possible. You want to make them look like they're about to just start up and drive off. That's kind of the point, right?
Yeah.
Or at least make them evoke some sort of human emotion, recognition of an event, mark something, some event. And that can be real. I remember we talked about some emotive subjects before when we were talking about like different models that had approached the subject of the Holocaust, for instance.
Yeah.
There was the reaction that you would have is a real reaction.
Hmm.
So it doesn't really matter what the model looks like, because the idea is what you interpret as.
Hmm.
It's not a scale model to replicate what something looked like exactly. It's to replicate or remember a piece of history.
If we were just to be bold and say that people that make models are artists, does that make us impressionists?
That's interesting, isn't it? We have to go into some sort of fine art argument, aren't we? Into impressionism and surrealism and talk about Caravaggio and Ways of Seeing by John Berger and all that kind of stuff. Have you read Ways of Seeing by John Berger?
I haven't, no. No.
It was turned into a BBC series back in the 70s. So it was probably something you haven't seen. But he wrote a book, and he basically talks about the way that we interpret images in our brain. If you see a race car go past at speed, your brain is not going to be able to process all of the images of that race car.
Uh-huh.
It's just going to see a blurry thing drive past. And you might, I recognize the shape as being a Ford Sierra, or I recognize the shape as being a Ferrari or whatever, or Lada in your case.
Mm-hmm.
But you would also recognize the color of that thing. Might not catch the number. You might not catch what make the wheel was. You'll see it's going fast and the noise of it, but that's kind of all the information you have. And the rest of that information is filled in by your knowledge of that vehicle that you've seen in the past.
Uh-huh.
Maybe you saw it earlier, static or something. But if all you see of that thing is something blurry and flying really fast, you're not going to have much detail or much information about it. Also, if you are really excited that person's going to win, or if you're really cross because you put money on the other driver, that might influence how you see that car. And all of those little factors come in, because we don't have photographic memories, or some people say they do. We don't have photographs in our brains that can keep an image of something exactly. So when we're making or painting things from memory, those things can get clouded because of human error.
Yeah, just by the way in which we remember things.
Yeah.
Key elements can be disrupted quite easily in anything that we see or do, meaning our memory is not 100% correct.
Nope. Fallible, completely fallible. You see that when they'll do a crowd experiment where they'll simulate a robbery or something, and then they'll interview everybody in the room, and everyone says he had a red coat on. So one person says he had a red coat on, so everyone suddenly remembers a red coat and would swear blind that he had a red coat, but then the video plays and he's got a black coat on.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've seen the argument scale model critique group,
yep,
where they always talk about
no chief technician would ever.
That comes from a memory of how somebody would react if they saw a dirty aircraft. It's almost hard to accept for someone whose job it was to look after aircraft to accept that they would get that dirty.
Mm.
And I can understand why they would say that. If you took a photograph of my car right now and showed it to me, I would deny that it would ever get that dirty.
Yeah.
Because I don't want me to be seen to have a dirty car.
Yeah.
I want to have a nice clean car. I look after my vehicles. Well, the car wash does. But I wouldn't want to admit that that would ever happen. And I guess that's probably something to do with it. You know, it's a human element.
Mm.
But saying all that, we do have the technology of photography. We do have video. We can 3D scan things now. And obviously the technology these days is so intensely good that we can document everything in computers now and print them. Wander into the tank museum at Bobbington, scan your Sherman, plug it into your computer, hit print, and then it would print a 3D print of that Sherman, right? You could say that would be 99.9999% accurate. So would that be real?
No, because it's a representation. It's not real because you can't get in and drive around the fields and shoot people with it, with the big pointy gun thing.
Well, if you're a member of the Imps, then you could.
Well, that's true. It's quite funny, actually, because I tend not to do a great deal of research on the subject. Let's say, for example, I've got a Fokker D7.
What did you call me?
A Fokker D7. I don't have any books on that aircraft other than what's provided to me in that box. Now, yeah, of course, I can Google. I can go and search for some information. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm hoping that that Edward kit is as accurate as it should be, because they've done the research, they've made the product, and they've called it a Fokker D7, so it must be a D7.
Right.
If that's what it says on the box, that's what it is in my mind.
So if I went and snuck into your house at night, balaclava on, with the intention to break and enter, and I swapped out your Vesterflug that you're going to do for your 48-hour build, okay? I swapped that out for a Harrier.
Right.
I put the instructions in there, I put the sprues in there, and then I snuck out again and left no trace, okay?
Yeah.
When it came to the 4-hour building, you open up that Vesterflug, and there was a Harrier in there. Are you saying you would then just build it as was?
Clearly, the aircraft are very, very different, and the picture wouldn't be the same as what's on the instructions. I twig it.
Yeah.
But in this world of possibilities, if, for example, someone had incorrectly named a kit and everything else was exactly the same, so that the instructions was thing you were building. Say, for example, it said on there Harrier, but everything else was what it should be for a Fokker D7, I'd believe it was Harrier because that's what it says on the box.
Gotcha.
And then someone would say,
James, that's not a Harrier. That's a Fokker D7, you fool.
What the kit manufacturer says to you is gospel, is what you're saying. That's your reality.
I'm not going to lie. I'm lazy. But I would assume, correctly or incorrectly, that the manufacturer has done his research, dial in the cockpit in the right place, you know, the seats facing the right way, all those sort of things. I assume that that's correct. If I was building that for Shuttleworth, for example, which is a museum in England, which has a lot of World War One aircraft, if they said to me, James, I'd like you to build a Fokker D7 for us and so we can put it on display and it'll show everybody exactly what it was, like that. In that scenario, I would have to do some research. I'd have to double make sure that Edward had done their homework correctly. Luckily, the reason I've chosen that particular aircraft is because a friend of ours, Steph, recently built a Fokker variant, and on the instructions, it said that the colour of the rear end of the aircraft went a certain amount of way up the fuselage, but in reality, it didn't. They made a mistake. Now, it was important to him to check that. I would have made that mistake, because if that's what it said on the instructions, I would have done it and assumed it was correct. Because my attitude before I even start the model is it is a representation of the subject, that fine detail doesn't really make a great deal of difference to me. How about you? Do you feel like that when you open your kit, or are you a little bit more mischievous in your research?
Well, before I answer that, I want to address the fact that you think you're lazy because you don't do the research that a kit presents you. I don't think that's lazy at all.
It's not part of the process to me, unless it's something in which, I mean, I've spoken to about it before, a British B-17. The only reason I've done that research is because I want to do something a little bit different to what everyone else would do,
yeah,
or that's not on the box art.
Right.
So, yeah, in that occasion, that, you know, if I'm honest, that majority of the time, that's the extent of my research.
You're then just relying on the research you can do from the book, and that could be tainted too. That could be incorrect as well.
Yeah.
Unless you've got the real thing right in front of you, it's not going to be real.
When you say that, picking you up on that, and also the comment you made about the Sherman, you've already made that assumption that that one-to-one scale item that you're looking at is correct.
Mm, yeah.
And something like a World War One aircraft, yes, it's got parts of it that were from World War One, but how much percentage is correct from when it was built originally to what it is now?
Yeah. It would have been cleaned, no doubt, repainted.
Bits replaced.
Yeah, fixed and gone backwards and all sorts of things. Unless you're actually there at the time. Because it's incredibly fallible. It's a folly exercise. There's no way that you can ever do it.
Maybe that's why I don't do it, is I see it as a bit of a folly. Mm. But funny enough, I did a video some time ago, which was a comparison video between two kits. 148th B-17s. One was an old monogram stroke Revell kit, and the other one was the new HK kit. And I made a comment about the different surface detail and how they achieved it on the molds. The reason I bring it up is because only this week I had a message from someone who'd watched the video. And it's been on my YouTube channel for some time. But he said,
model makers needed to get off their high horse about recessed panel lines and all that sort of thing. And the reason being that the panel lines are not recessed, because if they were recessed, the aircraft wouldn't fly properly. What you actually do is you sand the raised panel lines down to the point where they are not recessed enough to give you the illusion that they are panels in the aircraft.
Doesn't say that in the instructions, though.
It doesn't say that in instructions. No, absolutely not. And it was not something in which I'd ever thought of doing. Maybe it's because I've just not come across it or whatever. But he said that he was someone that maintains aircraft, and it always annoys him that we bang on about recessed panel lines. And that was part of the comment I made in the review that I did, where I did the comparison.
Oh, you talked about the panel lines. So yeah. In him complaining about people banging on about recessed panel lines, he made a comment on YouTube about recessed panel lines.
Yeah, he basically said that he was basically saying that as modelers, we didn't need to have recessed panel lines because that wouldn't be accurate.
Okay.
The panels the joint between panels isn't recessed. It is just a joint.
Yes, I'm with you. Well, depending on the aircraft, to be honest.
to make a representation of that, it wasn't necessary to have recessed. You just needed something like the old kits that you sanded down so it was almost flat but not, so that when you painted it, it gave you somewhere for the paint to gather, create shadows, etc. And I found that, I mean, only a few comments between ourselves, but I found that quite fascinating as a view. And again, that brings us to the realism side of things. But because of his employment, he felt it was important that he made that comment.
Right, okay.
That's a good idea. I'm going to try that approach on a raised panel line, an old kit, and see whether I can achieve that. Or whether, actually, the reason we have recessed lines is because it's a lot easier and a lot less fapping about, which I suspect is possibly what it's about.
I remember standing in front of one of the Red Arrows while it was in service. The two halves of the nose cone, across the top middle, was a big, thick black line full of grease. It was very deep. I remember thinking, crikey, I wonder if they represent that line on the models, because I would sand that out.
Yeah.
Probably hide my little finger in it. Yeah, that was how deep this was. Maybe that's the reason it was in for service, though. Didn't think of that.
No.
I remember people talking about all sorts of different aircraft, saying that they would just leak oil constantly because they were just not put together correctly and they just had massive holes and gaps in them. Mm. If aircraft were all put together perfectly, then they wouldn't leak oil at all, would they?
Nope.
You know, so they're going to have gaps and everything else in them. It comes down to whether you really care how microscopically accurate your panel lines are and whether they're perfectly represented in your model, and whether your model is a museum level replica of a thing or whether it is you getting away from it all trying to build something fun, or whether it is you trying to memorialize something about a regiment or a conflict or you know, somebody you know who was involved in those subjects. And at that point, it doesn't think it matters how raised your panel lines are, whether it's the right shade, whether it's weathered completely correctly, or even if it's flying, airspeed indicator says zero.
Well, you know as well as I do, from if I got asked to make a representation of, let's say, a warrior, because somebody had served in a regiment that had those, I would be absolutely scared to death to do it. Basically, someone's asking you to, well, I've got this memory in my head. Can you make a 3D image of it?
It's never going to be perfectly correct, but it's going to smell right and it's going to be the right kind of shape. And they'll recognize it as a warrior, but it might not have the right type of sound filters on it. It probably hasn't got the guys asleep in the back on it.
And it, hopefully it's sufficient enough to evoke memories, good times and all that. So
that's it.
So that sort of sums up my feeling in realism is about evoking a reaction. And you touched upon it earlier about the argument of depicting certain scenes and whether they are crude or the unspoken subject and gruesome body parts and all that sort of stuff where they're depicting a battle scene, etc. Do we need to go that finer detail? Is there a way in which you can do it, which evokes a memory, which invokes a reaction without pouring gloss red paint all over your figures? And I think you can, is the answer. I think you can achieve that with an element of subtlety. As someone has expired on the battlefield, then there are ways in which you can show that without a pool of blood. Because you're, as humans, we are aware because we've watched films and we've seen the news and all that sort of thing. It's a very delicate line in which you can depict anything from that sort of scenario without evoking a incredibly passionate reaction. And dare I say, a incredibly negative reaction, which is not what you're trying to achieve if you ventured down that road.
If you're trying to depict or say something about an event, it's going to cause a reaction. And that's kind of the whole point. You want it to elicit a reaction. That's what art is, isn't it? That's what, whether it's negative or positive, it's still a reaction. I remember a long, long time ago, I was at the Tate Museum in London, UK. There was someone in there and they were complaining about Tracy Emin's bed. Do you remember that?
Oh, God, yeah, that was a long time ago. But yes, I do remember it.
Right? It was a messy bed, and that literally is all it was, a replica of the way that she lived her life in her bedroom, and there was all sorts of rubbish all over the floor and everything else. And people were very shocked because, what is that? Is that art or not? I remember reading so many articles in the newspaper about Tracy Emin's bed. How can they put this on? It's disgusting. It's gross. How would she even live like that? What a disgusting thing. And the conversation was exactly what she wanted. She wanted you to talk about it. She wants you to talk about how rubbish her bedroom is. And that is the artwork. That is the reaction. It's not a beautiful bunch of flowers. Oh, what a beautiful bunch of flowers. It's, oh, what a shitty bed.
Mm.
And that's the end of the story. Ironically, nobody got that. Well, of course they did, but I didn't see any newspapers talking about the fact that everybody was talking about it.
Yeah, there wasn't any articles saying how clever it was that a conversation had been evoked by presenting that item.
Yeah, and it was all about, oh, how terrible it is.
I can't remember the artist, forgive me, but the artist that cut animals in half and then displayed them, that was the same thing, wasn't it? It was about the conversation. That was the idea behind the artwork, was to create a conversation.
They had a sheep and he did life cycle of a shark or a sheep or a cow or something, and all different animals.
There was a cow, a shark. I remember a cow, a shark, and a sheep.
Yes. Yeah. And people were upset because it was too real, I guess, because it was literally the thing.
Well, there was a lot of complaints that it was cruel.
Right. They weren't alive when they were cut in half.
If they went out of their way to find an animal, caught it, killed it for that purpose, I suppose it's cruel.
That is another podcast.
That's a whole different thing. But they didn't cut them up when they were alive. We've gone off kilter a little bit, as per usual.
No, we haven't. We're completely on kilter because we're talking about realism. And this is Damien Hirst is the chap we're talking about.
Yes.
Those were the actual animals. They weren't models of animals. So if you wanted to do this a similar thing, would you go and dig up a B-17 that had crashed and then stick it in a museum? Cut it open and stick it in a museum? And the answer is no, you bloody couldn't, because you would then be changing that history. You'd be moving those things that were
War grave,
place of where people died. War grave, that's it. You'd have to take photographs of it because you wouldn't be able to pick that whole thing up. I guess we have museums, but they wouldn't leave them the way they are to show them. They would do them up, make them nice and pretty.
I had to preserve them, don't they? If you think of the Mary Rose, you know, that was a very old ship, wooden ship, that was found, brought up from the seabed. I can't remember what year that was, but I think they're still spraying water on it to keep it going.
Yeah, that's right.
They had to dry it out. They had to then cover it with other stuff to preserve it where it got to, and then they had to dry it out again, and then they had to keep it wet. And it's gone through so many different cycles. It isn't what it was on the seabed because it's not covered in mud and silt and whatever. Again, with that, if I wanted to make a model of that as a representation of it, then yes, I would use pictures, of course. Yes, I would use some sort of information that would give me the right curbs, etc., and all the rest. But realistically, I've got a bit of freedom, haven't I? To make it the real element that I want, depending on how I want to display it, i.e. if it's at the bottom of the seabed.
Yeah, which means is if you wanted to make the model as it was before she sunk or as she is now, are you talking about the museum rebuilding her so that she would float again?
Well, no, just the fact that it's gone through so many processes that if I wanted to recreate any of those moments before it went to the next process, for example, yeah. Although there are pictures, there's still a little bit of leeway for the realism side of it for my interpretation of how it would have looked. And that's it. And the reason I've chose that is because that's very off the wall and everybody's probably sat there going, I don't really quite follow what he means. But that's my point about making a, for example, B-17. They won't all look the same. The paint schemes won't all be the same. The fading on them won't all be the same. The engine staining won't always be the same. You know, how it looked when it came out of the factory isn't the same as how it looked when it came out of service, blah, 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 blah. The main elements of realism for me for a model is that the wings are where they're meant to be on a plane, the engines are in the right place, and it's all pointing the right way. That work has been done by the manufacturer. If you're making it from scratch, that's a whole different level of dedication to the art of making models, but you will again come across a point where if you're making it from scratch, if you're using certain pictures and certain information, that might not be correct to other information that's out there. And that's happened in model manufacturers where they've used a certain amount of information, made a kit, and then had to go back and rejig something because the shape of the nose isn't 100% right because the information they were working on was wrong.
Literally, scratch building things from absolute scratch using blueprints and things like that, you would care about realism because you would want to be as real as you could from the very beginning so that everything carries on being real. Does that make sense? Because if you make your hull slightly wrong, I'm thinking about Chris Meddings. Yeah, have you seen his stuff?
Yes.
Yeah, so I know he's made a ship on his Twitter feed, and he had the hull of the ship. And obviously, if you start with that and it's slightly out, then everything else you put on that is going to have to be slightly out too. Mm. And so you probably end up with it looking remarkably different than it would unless you were as accurate as you can all the way through. So, yeah, I would imagine that he would want the most accurate and real blueprints and copies and photographs that he could make his interpretation, his sculpture of that particular ship as real and as representational as possible. Mm. I'll have to find it and put a picture up because it's really quite nice.
I think Chris just recently did a French tank. Was it a French Renault?
It was an armour, wasn't it?
Yeah, I watched his progress through that and fairly certain he was making the turret and got quite a way into it, and then suddenly realised that the angle wasn't quite right. So he had to put back a few stages. But yeah, that's fascinating. But for Chris, in that scenario, I can imagine the element of realism is much more astute for him because he's having to make something from scratch. And that sort of reflects back to my comment about being a lazy modeler. I just pick a kit up and follow the instructions because they've done all that work for me.
You assume that they have gone out with a measuring stick and measured everything correctly and done their homework.
Absolutely. And, you know, the small amount of scratch building I have done, I've scratch built a bath.
It looks like a bath. That'll do.
You know, it's just something to make the person viewing the diorama go, oh, that's a bathroom there. It's because that's a bath.
Yeah, so it's an impression of a bath.
Yeah, it is very much an impression.
And that's what impressionism is, isn't it? When you talk about it in a classical painting sense, an impression of a lily pad, for example, is a blob of green paint on a blue background.
Mm.
That is the impression of a lily pad. It's not a lily pad. It is an impression of it.
Mm.
So that when you look at it, you think, oh, what beautiful load of lily pads. Yeah, it doesn't matter whether it's detailed. It doesn't matter whether you can see if it's got a frog or a toad.
Frog.
Probably a frog.
Toad.
Toad, okay.
Okay.
We're going with Toad.
Rabbit.
There'll be a Toad on that lily pad. It doesn't matter because it's a lily pad, and that's what matters to the story. So when you're building your building, you're putting a bath on, you just want that bath there to say this was a bathroom. But that's not the point of the story. It's not about the bath wars of 1976. You know, it's something else.
And they were very important bath wars.
That's memorable.
Yes.
My dad was a plumber at the time. Oh, awful.
The siege of the plugs.
The rise of the shower. What was I saying? There's actually a chap who will also want to bring your attention to. He has lots of different outlets on social media. His name is... hang on. Name is...
His name is...
Alfonso... we'll put a link up. He's won 12 Golden Demon Awards, okay? It's 2 Slayer Awards, which is similar. He's won Best Fantasy Figure in Monte Sansovino in 2019. He's also a Crystal Brush Award winner. And the way that he approaches his painting of miniatures is impressionist in that he starts with lots of blocks of colour. Now, we all do, I guess. We all put base colour on. You know, if he's wearing jeans, they'd be blue. If we're wearing a T-shirt, put the white. Flesh color, and then we start to build up the colors and the highlights and the tones and things. He doesn't do it that way. Like, say, if he's painting a man's chest, for instance, he looks at the areas of where the pectorals are, that would be all one color. He'd do abs, all the different colors, and he would make sure that he's got the right shades and tones as he's painting, and he's using a very large brush, so he's not bothered about it being accurate in terms of precision. And some of his stuff is just mind-blowingly gorgeous, and they look like oil paintings. They don't look so much three-dimensional, they're like two-dimensional, but it captures the light so well. There's one here I'm gonna send you the link to, and we'll put it up. There you go, have a look at that. This is a Viking, right? So he's got a big beard, big hunky chap, just like me, and he's got a big shoulder pad on. Yeah,
like looking in the mirror, Malcolm.
Just like looking in the mirror. Now, you see that his painting, it's not accurate. If you look closely, you can see the brush lines. You can see where he's put blobs of paint on. Uh-huh. He cares about how the thing looks in its entirety, like as a picture, rather than hiding mistakes. Now, if you look at that now, that's beautiful, right? It's beautifully painted.
Yeah.
But looking close, you can see where perhaps that could be blended a bit better, like his eye, the cheeks and things like that. Uh-huh. The point is, as an entire picture, that's an impression of this Viking dude.
I tried following somebody's tutorial on how to do figure painting, and I just couldn't understand it, because what was happening was I got this figure, it's a 1/35 figure in my hand, I'm busy painting it, and I can see exactly what you just pointed out happening on my figure. Mm-hmm. I can see big blobs, I can see gaps, I can see lines of brush strokes, etc. Mm-hmm. And drove me nuts. It wasn't until someone said to me, yeah, that's fine, there's nothing wrong with that. And it's like, well, no, because I can see that. He said, best thing to do is take it out in the garden, hold it at arm's length, and tell me what it looks like.
Yeah.
And that was the key. I hadn't taken into account, because I'm looking at it 6 inches away from my nose as I'm painting it with my magnifying glasses on, I'm trying to blend it all in so that, you know, you can't see those lines. You can't. And then when you hold it away from you at the arm's length, it suddenly doesn't look right. Yeah?
Yeah.
And so many people fall for that trap. And also, we fall foul of light awful lot as bottlers. Because it actually happened at the same time with the same subject that I was just talking about the figures. And I said to the person, the lighting in my little man cave is perfect. It's all daylight bulbs. It's all this, it's all that, you know, it's really crisp, it's clear and blah, blah, blah. And the person said to me, where are your lights? And I said, well, right above the bench. Not going to give you the right light then, is it? The light outside isn't right above your bench. What was the word he used?
Diffuse.
Thank you. Light is diffused all around you. It's not focused, whereas your lights above you are focused. And I was like, no, I hadn't thought of that. I've run after this realism thing so much without actually meaning to a lot of the time as well. And like I say, in this particular scenario with the figures, we spend so much time concentrating on it at the at the bench that we forget this, the most important and serious thing to do. Take a break, walk away, come back at it. Don't try and chase it, because if you chase it, you'll just chase your tail.
What I love about this photograph that he's got of this, he's obviously clearly really enjoyed painting it, putting it together.
Mm.
He does a lot of videos on YouTube as well, and he is a massive advocate for not caring about your brush strokes.
Mm.
He's got brush strokes, who cares? You know, just put them down. It's part of the painting process. You're painting a thing. A lot of scale modeling is trying to hide the fact that you've painted it or you've made it. You know, you don't want to show any sign that there's plastic underneath. You don't want to show any sign that there's a human has painted it with a brush, that it's not a model anymore. It's an actual thing. The stretching for that, I think, clouds a lot of people's enjoyment of this hobby over turning something between a replica and what is a fun giggle, essentially.
Most modelers will make a model, take a picture of it, put it somewhere for someone to go, oh, that's nice. And we all dislike intensely when someone says, oh, you've done that wrong. Oh, that's not quite right. That wouldn't have chipped like that, or panel lines wouldn't be as defined as that. So maybe that's a part of the realism side as well, is we're trying to please other people's eyes. And that's where we can get caught up in the chasing of the realism and avoiding brushstrokes.
You're caring what other people think.
Let's go back to the figure. We're doing a figure, and I'm making this figure, I'm painting this figure, and I'm like,
oh yeah, I like that, it looks really cool, I'm going to put it into a competition.
So yeah, I've got to worry about what other people might think about it, but I am 100% happy with it. That was my biggest thing that was in my head when I did enter a piece into a competition, was
it's the best I can do right now. I'm happy with what I did, because that shows my skill level right now.
Yeah.
And yeah, if I win something, yay, fantastic. But if I don't, that's okay, because I know that that's the best I can do right now.
That kind of confidence comes with a lot of time and a lot of inward reflection.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't come naturally, I'm sure.
I'm not confident most of the time with a lot of things I do. Even when I'm really, really happy with it and, yeah, that's the best I can do, I'm not 100% confident. I'll give you an example. The Musaru build had its first outing this weekend just gone.
Oh, right, yeah. Talk about that. You haven't told me about this.
I took it to a small model show, the first model show of the year for me, which is the...
Small?
Yeah, it's quite small in the scheme of things.
Okay.
Lovely venue. It's at the Shuttleworth Collection in Biggleswade in the UK. It's quite fascinating, actually, because I put it on a table display for a charity table. The museum itself is mainly predominantly aircraft and predominantly First World War. And to have a robot, effectively... Perfect setting next to the Fokkers and the Camels of the world. He's a Bandai robot.
Perfect audience.
I'm happy with what I did. I'm happy with how it's turned out. It's come out as I envisaged it, but I feel it's the best that I could have achieved given what I wanted to do. It's certainly not down to time, because I've had loads of time to do it. I've got to say, I've not rushed it at all.
I was going to say.
I have not rushed it. But given the circumstances of where it was, the general reaction from people was quite good.
People were like, oh, yeah, it's quite unusual. It's quite cool. I like the paintwork, blah, blah, blah.
There was very much a demographic difference as to who liked it and who didn't.
Who said they didn't like it? Because they didn't comment on it, or they didn't like it because they just walked past it?
There was a couple of people that talking about the models that were on the table, and one person said to the other, what
do you think of that? That's not for me.
Doesn't mean they didn't like it.
No, they didn't go,
oh my God, that's really bad. You didn't do this right. You didn't do
none of that. They wouldn't have dared. Yeah, it was quite interesting to see people's reactions.
That made you nervous?
To say I was nervous, I was more nervous about getting out of the car and its journey and getting in one bit and getting it home in one bit than I was actually while it was there.
You do have a thing about that, don't you?
Yeah. I was nervous in its general reaction, more concerned of the fact that it was a little bit out of place in a way.
Right. Okay.
Even the show that it was at, it went down well. And my favourite part of the day, which I didn't take her name, unfortunately, was a young lady. I would say she was probably about 8 years old, and her dad was busily getting all excited over a model that was on the table. It happened to be a Steph's Big Fokker, which mentioned to the young lady, what do you think of that? And she went,
yeah, I much prefer that one.
Pointed towards my build for the Mercury Cup and went,
that one's just cool.
So that was the comment of the day for me.
Oh, well, there you go. Out of the mouths of babes, truth be spoken or something, isn't it?
Something like that, yeah.
That confidence to show your stuff. I mean, that's another podcast, isn't it, really? Off topic again. But that confidence to show your stuff and be criticized and be confident that your stuff is good enough, I think takes time for some people, certainly.
Oh, yeah.
I remember inviting people to come and display stuff on our club tables, and people would say, oh, no, not yet. I'm not quite good enough. If you think that, then you never will be good enough.
No.
If you attempt a model, I mean, it's just a really daft hobby and it's difficult. If you attempt a model and you even get to the point where you can put some paint on it, you've done very well. So the space you have on the table is perfectly granted. This is your space. Please put your model there and display it and be bloody proud of it.
Mm. I had that conversation with someone and someone actually said that phrase that I'd used previously, which was, is that the best that you can achieve right now? And I was like, well, yeah, so then it's good enough. And I thought that was really, really kind of someone to say that to me because, you know, thinking that through, you know that what I'm like, I will go away and think the bejesus out of that comment. It works at every level. It's just logical.
I'm interested to find out how other people feel, whether realism is an issue for them, whether their chase of realism is important to them, and whether having the confidence to say, yes, this is the best I've got, this is as real as it's going to get, you don't like it, tough. Do they have in model competitions an impressionist category where the strive isn't for realism, but the strive is for it to look good at a distance? You know? So like if you're in a model competition and someone put a Monet in there, it's not going to win because it's, you know, probably not in the bloody right category for a start. But it wouldn't win at all. It would get disqualified. But if it was in the impressionist painting section of a model, what I'm trying to say is, competitions are always trying to find the most real and most non-model looking thing, aren't they? The wheels have to be straight. There have to be no signs of glue marks. The paintwork has to be impeccable. And it's always about realism, isn't it, with competitions? Do you think?
I think, yes, to a degree, you're right. But there are categories where realism is not all the be-all and end-all.
Right.
And dioramas fall into that category to a point because it's an overall impression. So you can get away with a few things that aren't 100% right.
It's a story you're telling, isn't it?
Yeah, the diorama is much more about, has the message of what you're telling in that story come across?
Yep.
Yes, a Sherman being painted green with yellow spots probably wouldn't win because that's not real. But that's not to say it never happened. But yeah, you get away with a lot more. When you start getting down to, you know, a fixed wing aircraft at 1/72nd or between 19 whatever to 19 whatever, then yes, it's all about the fact that the Tomcat has the right colours, the engine exhaust stains are exactly where they should be and all that sort of stuff. But again, it's down to the impression that's given. You tend not to see judges picking up dioramas, but you do see them picking up figures and subject matter. So, and having a closer inspection at the rivets.
Or taking a protractor to the profile of a Spitfire to make sure that the wheels at the correct angle.
Oh, yeah.
And are exactly symmetrical.
Yeah.
You wouldn't do that on a diorama, is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, if you had a Spitfire on a diorama.
Well, this is where it gets complicated because people get quite upset over things. We're talking about displaying your models. We're saying there that it's important to have a base, and people do put their models into competitions with bases, and some people will put a little bit more into the base than maybe they need to when they're putting it into a subject like, for example, you just said, Spitfires. They're looking for that detail, that realism and accuracy of making sure the angle is 100% correct on the landing gear and all that sort of thing. But someone that's done a base that's got, a man refueling it, it's not taken into account in the competition because that's not part of the category. And I've seen it time and time again where an amazing build of a aircraft, It just so happens it is aircraft each time I've seen it happen. Amazing build quality, everything's beautiful, and it's stuck on a base that's really busy with men running around with ammunition and God knows what else. And it didn't win. And sometimes it sort of just tracks away from what I'm actually meant to be looking at. So you get a minus point. Or, turn that 360, the person's put it on a base and made it busy because they want you not to see the faults that they're hiding, which I've seen that happen as well.
Really? Gosh.
Yeah. So, and again, that twists it all right back down to the beginning, which is realism, model making, it's all in the eye of the beholder. It's down to you interpret what you're building, what you're looking at.
Yeah. Yeah. Does it make me think of a Sherman if I'm looking at Sherman? Does it make me think of Spitfires having scrambled to fight off the German invasion? Is that what we're trying to do? I suppose it is, isn't it? Yeah. Otherwise, we'd be making models of trees. That was good fun. That was good fun chat. That was like that. Whether we made any sense or...
Whether you can make a podcast out of it, it's...
Well, it's literally what we've been doing for over a year.
Got away with it so far, yeah. Absolutely. Oh, I tell you what we haven't done. Not that there's not really a lot to do. It's Mushroom.
Okay. Would you want to do a live version of the jingle?
Mushroom.
That. I don't sound like that.
I can't remember where it goes.
Just because you don't listen to our bloody podcast. Musaru.
What's this? Musaru. What's all that?
That's my beautiful voice.
You're taking your Pavarotti stance.
Musaru. We should do that next time. Go on then. Musaru update. Here you go.
Musaru Cup. The Musaru Cup. Let's talk about the Musaru Cup. Boom.
Woohoo. The build is now complete. Pictures are out and about for you to look at. If you want to see a series of pictures explaining the awesomeness that I achieved, put in there all the W's, buymeacoffee.com/JMC podcast, and it'll go straight to us. There's a series of pictures on there from start to finish of how I did the build, and that's exclusive. That'll only be on the buymeacoffee.com.
Go suck in the awesomeness. It is really nice. I do absolutely love it. Was it... How did it look on the table then when you were displaying it at Shuttleworth? Did it, guessing it looked out of place because it was about World War One biplanes and whole place, but did it, how did it look on a table in a display?
Yeah, it didn't look out of place.
Ah.
It looked like it was a model on a table of models. So yeah, it didn't look out of place in that respect. I liked how it looked. For those of you who haven't seen it, I don't know. The figure is a Bandai figure, a mobile fighting suit, a Gundam. And what I've done is I've actually made it stand in the doorway of an airlock, the best way of explaining it. So I prefer actually to put it onto a little stand, which is one of those table stands for an iPad. So it's a slight angle, which helps the viewer see the model, but also makes it look like it's the side of a spaceship sort of thing.
Well, it's in space, so it could be rotating and twisting and everything else.
I could just so do that.
Are you going to put it on a turntable?
On a turntable so it rotates around. Oh, yeah, no, I won't do that.
Well done. I know you've done a couple of lives, but not many. Are you going to do anything about the build? Or did you end up doing a box review or anything like that?
I think I did a box review. Yeah, I can't remember. And I did one live.
Because I know that a lot of people are going to go, how did you do the effect with this?
That's what I said about the photos, is because I've got pictures of how I've done things step by step.
Yeah.
And it's a lot easier just to throw that up and write a little bit of blurb underneath it saying, well,
I stuck the stickers on individually, one by one, and after 2 hours, I messaged my friend.
If you had to do it all again, if they said, actually, sorry, we sent you the wrong kit, James, could you do it all again? Well, how would you do it?
Oh, yeah. Well, I like the way it is. If they said, I'm ever so sorry, we're going to send you another kit, ask you to do it again, and this time you're not allowed to use any hexagonal shapes. Because there's a law against hexagonal shapes, and we don't want to ban you, but at the same degree, you know.
Other shapes are getting jealous.
Yeah, the other shapes are available.
Yeah. I have got a mind for a couple of other schemes. If I'm honest.
Go on. I don't have my crystal ball. You have to tell me.
Well, Berlin camo or digital. I think digital would work better, if I'm honest. Just to make you smile, I have actually only today been looking at other Bandai kits. I hadn't done a kit like that before. the quality of the way it fits together and you still articulates and all that and the other, amazing. Really, really amazing. But what I struggled with was understanding how I was to paint that and at what point do I paint it. Now I've done one, I understand it a lot better. And I've seen areas in which I could have done that process a lot easier, a lot simpler. I tried to make it into little modules, so the modules were easier to make. And in some instances, that wasn't the right thing to do.
Okay, right. So you're going to do another one. You know, you could do a perfect grade one.
No, I'm not doing perfect grade. They're too expensive.
One of my buddies, another Malcolm, he is building a perfect grade Gundam. And the legs that he's done so far is about 12 inches high. But yeah, you're right. This is a lot of money. And if you've got money burning in a hole in your pocket, that's going to be a lot of fun.
I decided that what I was going to do was that I really like the way it is in its picture frame. I was going to get a couple more and do the same idea that the picture frame had to be the way it was displayed.
Okay. That's a good idea. I like that. Yeah.
It won't be an airlock next time. It might be something different. I don't know.
A window.
It could be battle damage, couldn't it? Coming out of the spaceship. Through battle damage or cockpit or...
Are you considering sending it to Built Sideways, the podcast about Gundam stuff?
I had anticipated putting it on Facebook on some Bandai stuff.
Yeah.
I thought about sending it to Bandai themselves and say,
is this unusual? Have I been really clever or is this what everybody does?
Oh, you went for the hexagonal. Yeah, everyone does that at the beginning. Next.
So making your model the way you want is key, but making those added touches to draw the eye to the conclusion of an impression of realism is all we can really, in reality, achieve in scale.
By adding effects of mud, dust and chipping, it only goes part of the way to deceive the eye into thinking a model is a true scaled-down version of the subject matter. After all, not even a picture is always a true representation of fact. I am Malcolm Childs.
And I am James Skiffins, and we are Just Making Conversation.
If you've enjoyed our podcast, consider leaving a review, as it promotes this podcast to more people to enjoy.
Showing your support to us is easy as making a cup of coffee. In fact, why not go over to buymeacoffee.com/JMC podcast and do just that. Your support will help go towards making the podcast and its content just a little bit better. A big thank you to our supporters.
Mark Bekawahi, Simon the Jersey Gent, Steve, Lee, Kilo Delta Pepper, Mark, Julian, Ray, Neil, Mike, Robert, Andrew, Jew, John, Mike, Jeff, Richard, Lynn, Gordon, and five others.
Who took the time to buy me a coffee. If you would like to grind some beans for us, come and join us on buymeacoffee.com/JMC podcast. If you do show your support, why not leave a message with your name so we can give you a shout out. Remember, there are other podcasts you can listen to. Head to modelpodcast.com for all the links.
Next time, we'll be just making a conversation about the model clubs and their furniture. Future.
The furniture used at model clubs.
Hey, look, in season 12, that might be what we're kind of scraping the barrel. What height is your bench at? Let's talk about that.
Good to know. I almost reached for a tape measure when you said that.
Yeah, I could do it. I got one right here. Hang on. Let's have a look. Mine is 80 centimetres off the ground. Why not measure your bench? Tell us how high it is.